You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
I just sort of fell into things. So I worked for the Herald as a feature writer, and then when I had children, I freelanced, and I've kind of been freelancing ever since. And I was the books editor at the Herald for a few years on contract, and then I kind of fell into ghostwriting, which I did because I thought I wanted to find out how you do a project as big as a book. And and before you know it, I've probably done about 14 of those things now, which is enough, I think.
What is ghostwriting?
Sorry. Ghostwriting is when you write as if you're the person, as if you're your subject. It's quite an interesting process, and I really love it, and I've worked with some amazing people. So I've mostly worked with Penguin Random and one or two of the other big publishers. They contract me because they have this some famous person that has an incredible story to tell, but they're not a writer. And so I sit with them for many hours and interview them about their life, and then I take that bulk of material and their voice and craft it into a book.
That's because in Whale Oil you talk about ghostwriting in a fairly negative way, right? In terms of what the effects of it could be negatively.
It can be really like that. So
when done dishonestly, I suppose that's the
That's right. So with the kind of ghostwriting I've done in those books, it's very much a collaborative process, and the person whose book it is, whose name is on the cover, reads it and makes sure they're happy with it and has to feel comfortable that I've captured their voice. But of course, I mean, if you were doing that in a destructive, negative, harmful way, this is the fake news thing, or deep fake, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, where you're actually really pretending to be something that you're not.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a great start to it all.
But my books were all very helpful things.
Yes, not to relate the two in that way, but just that term itself.
Yeah, I think there were things like the John Kerwin book called Blacks Don't Cry, the sort of mental health area. People, he's an incredible guy, but not a writer. So, so they're helpful things in that way.
Okay, let me start with, I'm just interested in obviously in the book you sort of explain, actually let's start with the book. Let's just go with the normal what you're supposed to do in a book launch.
Sure.
Tell us about Whale Oil.
Okay, I'll tell you about this book. It's an incredible story, and it kind of blew my mind as I was, going through the process of writing it. And if you read the book, you'll see that I kind of take readers on the same journey that I went through, because what happened was there's a guy, ordinary guy, lives in Auckland, a businessman, moderately successful. And one day he woke up and he found that on the Whale Oil blog, which was a very successful blog around about 2012, it was the biggest blog in New Zealand. It had hundreds of thousands of readers, run by a guy called Cameron Slater. My guy, Matt Blomfield, woke up one morning and found that on the Whale Oil blog was a series of articles beginning all about how awful Matt was. And it painted Matt in a terrible picture. It showed him to be a fraud and a pornographer and into drugs. And it just went on and on. And it ended up with there being well over 100 articles altogether, all about how terrible Matt was. And it had a devastating effect on Matt's life. His friends fell away, all his business opportunities dried up. He had been bankrupted a couple of years earlier, but he'd been clawing his way back and was allowed to work again. But with the onslaught of the Whale Oil articles, Matt got a call from the official assignee, which is the government body that oversees bankruptcies and which had given him permission to work again, and said, "No, you stop work right now. You're not allowed to work." And Matt said, "Why?" And they said, "Because of the Whale Oil articles." So everything about his life just kind of ground to a halt. And it quickly became apparent that what the articles were based on was 10 years worth of Matt's own stolen material, his digital files, and also four filing cabinets drawers with hard copies in them. And somehow Slater had got hold of this stuff, and he was using it as the proof of what he was writing about Matt, but they would be subtly changed. So they looked really bad. They looked real, but they looked really bad. And so Matt, I mean, you can imagine what that would be like. It's really like, it's like Kafka. It's like everywhere you look, there's just weirdness and surreality. And he just didn't know what to do, and he wasn't a lawyer, and he had no opportunity to work, and he basically had nothing to lose. And a lawyer friend of his said, well, you know, you could take a defamation action against Slater, and you can do some of these things called judicial reviews to try and get back your right to work. And Matt was like, what's that? But he's really a smart, smart guy, and he went and started reading. He read all these legal judgments and went into court and watched to see what happens in court, how lawyers act, how judges act. And he swung into action, and he took legal action against Slater to try and get the articles taken down and to try and get some redress and the acknowledgement that what Slater had written wasn't true. And that was 7 years ago. It took 7 years.
Wow.
And it was an incredible journey.
And it's still not finished, right?
Almost finished, but no, it's not finished. And so at the end of last year, he started to have some real victories. There was a week-long High Court hearing in which the judge dismissed everything about Slater's defence and said there was no defence to Slater, you know, for Slater. So that was a huge victory. Also, the Human Rights Review Tribunal, because Matt had gone through the Privacy Commission path as well, and the Privacy Commission handed it up to the Human Rights Review Tribunal, and they took 4 years to make their decision, but they came through and said it was a total character assassination and there was no basis for it, and they fined Slater $70,000, which Matt would probably never see. So there were all these validations and victories coming through, but it took him 7 years, and so the book kind of documents that journey, and it's awful and also kind of just relentless. And yeah,
I have to just say, because the book is called Whale Oil, and it's about Cameron Slater, but the story itself is Matt's, right? This is a story about Matt who I have to admit I had never heard of before this book.
And you wouldn't have, because he's not a famous person, you know, he's not a named person. He was just a guy going about his daily business, you know, a guy he was married, he had a couple of young kids, at that point he was in his 30s, he was just trying to make his way in the world, and then this happened, and it's like, well, why? You know, there was no public reason for it. And anyway, what unfolded, what became apparent, was that Matt was the victim of a conspiracy, which is a hugely loaded word, and a word that, you know, you can't hear without feeling kind of suspicious and doubtful.
Alarm bells, yeah.
But this is a clear example of a conspiracy. It turns out that Slater was paid to write the articles about Matt by a guy that Matt had been in business with but had fallen out with, who had had access to all Matt's stuff and had passed them to Slater and a little group of people. They called themselves Operation Bumslide, and they met together and went through all Matt's stuff and plotted out the lines of the attack articles. And Slater was paid one way or another, and the articles appeared on Whale Oil.
So a lot of the content, and I guess just the way that Cameron works as well, is a very personal attacks, it seems. The way that he writes is very personal. So what you uncover also in this book, but was also talked about in Dirty Politics, was the way that Cameron is paid to do this work. So you talk about him in the book, so I'll name him, Warren Powell. And this is the person that, at least, and I have to say, I haven't finished the book, so I don't actually know what it is. So I don't want to say that this is all, you know, conclusive, at least from my perspective. But it's alleged that he is the one who orchestrated this whole thing. And the question, I suppose, you are asking in the book is why, what was Warren's vendetta, right? That's the question. Am I right?
Yeah. Actually, when I first started working on this, so maybe just backtrack a little bit. Where the story comes from is, so you mentioned Dirty Politics, that Nikki Hager's book that came out in 2014, and that revealed exactly that Cameron Slater took money to run articles on his blog that looked like real news but were actually paid for by representatives, you know, indirectly by representatives from, you know, significant industries like alcohol and tobacco and sugar, groceries, you know, that kind of stuff. And had relationships with really important political figures and relationships that went right up to the Prime Minister's office. And Nikki Hager sort of revealed this whole thing. And so my book literally is a footnote within Dirty Politics. Okay. It's on page 12. And when Dirty Politics came out, and Matt was already 2 years into his battle against Slater, he was like blown away. You know, my God, it's someone else is taking on, right, you know, my enemy. And he'd never heard of Nikki Hager before, but he rushed out and bought a book and looked through it and found himself on page 12, just this little mention of Cameron boasting to someone that he had 12 gigabytes of information about a businessman. And so Matt rang Nikki and was, you know, introduced himself, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that conversation in a minute. But basically from there, Matt and Nikki met. Even Nikki was wary of Matt to begin with. You know, there was all this shit written about him, but over time got to know Matt and really, really rates him, really trusts him. And at some point, Nikki said to Matt, "I think you've got an incredible story. I think you know you should tell it." Yeah.
Sorry, can I interrupt? Because I want to come back to that suspicion thing, but you're right, I did sort of race ahead. I did have a whole kind of section on Nikki and Dirty Politics. It was it was more that I wanted to mention that, obviously, Nikki, he's written the foreword in your book.
Yeah.
And actually, what a weird thing that happened at the airport on the launch, or the day before the launch. And
that's so weird.
That was very weird. So somebody, I can't remember who, sorry, was carrying a manuscript of the
Matt,
book.
Matt, actually.
Matt was. Oh, Matt. My God. Yeah, okay, so this is how I didn't even know him before this. Yeah, okay, so the person who the book is about was traveling through the airport, and he got held up by airport security wanting to know what the book was about. Anyway, okay.
Yes, it was very peculiar. He was coming back from a holiday, and he had the manuscript, and it was a heavily embargoed book, and he was pulled out of the line, him and his two daughters and their young friend, and 2 hours they went through everything, and they found the book, and they were like, "What's it called? What's it called? What's the title?" And they said they would fine him $1,000 if he didn't tell them the title.
Wow.
Yeah, there's stuff. Yeah, it's very, very strange. But just yet another strange thing. There are a lot of strange
thing
things
that he's
happen,
had to sort of face. Okay,
well,
because I also didn't want to necessarily, I didn't want to take away from either book, because Dirty Politics and Whale obviously have a relationship, but they're also very sort of separate stories. So I was just going to ask you perhaps what is it that relates them and what makes them separate, if that makes sense.
I suppose, I mean, the obvious thing is Slater himself, and, you know, and that the ability to use a powerful digital media tool in a really destructive way. And so that's kind of the common thing. I mean, that's what Nikki revealed in Dirty Politics in very creepy sort of dark politics ways. And then the damage that can be done to individuals by this kind of thing. And I guess Matt is not your classic victim profile. You know, he's a Pākehā male, middle class sort of guy, and yet this terrible, terrible thing happened to him. I mean, we're more used to thinking of victims of hate speech as being particular demographic groups, you know, and that's a horrific thing to think about. You know, women, minorities, you know, Māori, are often the victims of hate speech. But here we have, you know, actually it can happen to anybody in a way, and the damage it can do to an individual. And I think that's, I mean, I got to really like Matt. I really respect him and regard him as a friend. But at the same time, his story to me was kind of a thing in itself, but also representative of these bigger issues.
So, okay, on that then, let's go into, because I've got, I suppose, two quotes. I mean, Nikki talks about your book saying it's a sobering story of how few protections there are in the digital age against these kinds of attacks. And then you've said Matt's case demonstrates sharply how we are not adequately protected within our super-connected new world. And this is sort of a major part of the story where during the years that this was happening, Matt just there was nothing to protect him.
Yeah.
And there were bits and pieces that were happening maybe around him, but nothing that kind of meant that right at that very moment he could have been protected. I mean, this that leads into the kind of big conversation around fake news as well that I want to touch on. But I guess just I'm now probably cut this right to the beginning because it is the beginning. It's about the way that you began this journey, and you've said it already. But the suspicion that you had, like Nikki had, when you first kind of introduced to Matt, and the fact that there are these horrible things on the internet about him. So of course, naturally, you have some suspicion when being approached by him, or when you initially start talking to him. And actually, what I find quite because now just listening to you in person talking about Matt, you speak about him with such generosity and kindness and respect, and you tell his story from a certain perspective, one who has, you know, told the story over however long you've told the story, and you've engaged with him. And so one might say that, I mean, you could be biased, but actually you could also say that you have all the information, and therefore you are telling a true and accurate representation of the story. Those who read the blog, though, don't have that information and are taking, you know, what they get from this blog. And I mean, that in itself, right, is a big issue with politics generally these days, and our democratic ways of sort of engaging, actually. That's a huge kind of lead up to, I suppose, our question. But in the sense that you and yourself, your process to write this book was an investigation, and you uncovered, I mean, you had to deal with massive amounts of information. So maybe if you can, whatever you took from that little rant, but talk about how important it is that we actually have all of the information, essentially, when making a decision. That's kind of where I'm getting to.
Yeah, I mean, it is really important, and we can't always get access to information, and we can't always know whether what we're reading is true. And so that is definitely a problem in this age. You know, we probably have more access to more information than any generation in the whole history of humanity. And in a way, and that's seen as a good thing, you know, that we can look up anything we want. And yet at the same time, I wonder whether the sheer bulk of it has kind of dulled our criticality, or, you know. And also, I mean, I guess something about it is like that we're really babies when it comes to this stuff. We are the first generation to coexist with the internet, and we're really feeling our way, and that's on the individual level and on the institutional level. So, I mean, if we look at the institutional level, which is what Matt came up against, you know, he had these things said about him on this blog, and people, an enormous number of people, including people in authority, believed what was written. They just, you know, no smoke without fire. You tend to believe what's under your nose. And that shaped the assistance that Matt was able or not able to get. And there's quite good evidence that two of the really key police officers involved in the inquiry, you know, that Matt went to the police for help. But it looks like they'd read Whale Oil, and they thought Matt was a crook. So there wasn't any help coming from there. And he made many attempts over the years, including at a later stage he got his system was hacked again in 2014. The police wouldn't even take a complaint from him about that. So he was very unsupported in that way. So I think that the institutions charged with protecting us have not quite grappled or grasped. They haven't quite grasped what can happen out there online, you know. And I think there needs to be a much more sophisticated understanding of just the way that harm can happen. And it's still going on, actually, because there's a Samoan journalist called Lani Young, and she's been really harassed online. There's been a lot of hate speech against her. I read something just yesterday, actually, where she'd gone to the police with her complaints, and they basically said, well, have you stopped writing the kinds of articles that inspired this kind of response?
What?
You know, maybe that would keep you safer.
Wow.
So actually, you know, I up until reading that, I would have said, you know, the stuff that happened with Matt began in 2012. You know, I would hope that they might be a little bit more clued up by now, but I'm not at all convinced they are. No.
That's devastating.
It's shocking.
I'm sort of not surprised because I'm, again, like you say, there are things that are coming out and people, and it might even be the same person, but in terms of reading, you know, responses saying, well, you should not be online or you should not say the things
online. Take yourself
online.
Offline.
It's like, well, then who are you deciding who gets to participate in that, in anything, really?
So it's not an answer, is it?
No.
And so another thing that actually is kind of slightly off to the side of my book, but I think it's really important in terms of our responses as individuals to all this stuff, is that we can actually upskill ourselves as individuals in this area. And there's a role here for those of us who belong to less harassed groups, perhaps. I mean, there's a program that's being run out of Action Station, which called Tō Iwi Tōtoko. And they're training volunteers to go online, look at the comment threads and articles where there's a lot of nasty hate stuff going on, and just try and sort of empathise, try and bring the tone of the discussion down a bit and try and open it up so people are in a better emotional state to listen to each other. Because, you know, I think we're all a bit guilty of quickly inflamed rage when we read stuff online, and it's really easy to jump in and be just as inflamed and almost abusive as the people whose opinions you don't like. And I think we can all take a bit of responsibility for just trying to bring the emotional level down and listen to each other a bit more. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm also jumping all over the place now just because there's different
Sorry,
threads.
Sorry, yes, I go for
No, that's
tangents.
Okay. So I'll go back to the fake news later. I just want to touch on because I had your point about the way that the police sort of treated people very differently, the way that they responded to Matt's complaints, but even using Nikki's example of all of, you know, his police raid, basically. So even just it's not new that police treat people differently in the sense that, you know, of course there's bias, there's all of that scholarship out there talking about that.
Yeah.
But actually just in the very concrete ways of perhaps understanding how to deal with something that you're not aware of how to deal with, I suppose. Is that an excuse for the police at this point?
No, I don't think it is, because they...
You talk about the police as being indifferent and impatient very early on towards Matt.
They were, yeah. I mean, I think it's hard to separate an institutional culture from the behaviour of individuals, isn't it? And it's really hard to know the truth of that. And you know, I do think that the police, you know, to their credit, have made some big advances in some areas. Like, I mean, if we look at, you know, the way that they've dealt with the victims of domestic violence, for instance, and rape, they take that a lot more seriously now. And that's a cultural shift within the police, and it's not perfect, but it's definitely something that they acknowledge and do take steps to make sure that they're behaving, you know, that they're dealing with it in the right way. So that's an institutional culture thing. So, and I wondered within this if it was an institutional culture, just this kind of lack of empathy. You know, there was just no acknowledgement. Even if they thought there was no legal case to answer, there wasn't a breath of sympathy to this person whose entire life was being spread all over the internet. It was often when I was researching this, I'd be reading through police files and I would just start to feel this really visceral kind of reaction, you know. My heart would start pumping because it's just so unfair.
And it's because you even question in the book, you talk about the social contract.
Yes.
Were just like, this, I mean, isn't this what we sign up to?
Absolutely.
Why is that not happening?
I know that, and that's right. And that was quite a light bulb for me, because I thought, well, maybe I'm just being over emotional and silly about this. But actually, no, this is the deal we strike. We pay our taxes, we obey the laws, we're good, and we don't carry guns around and weapons. But in return for that, we expect the state, and you know, these arms of the state to take care of us and be there when we need them.
You don't have to answer this, obviously, because people can read the book, but is that question ever answered for you?
Not really, no. I tried to get comment from the police on this, and I got no comment. And I went back to them and I said, there are a number of criticisms of the police in this book, and, you know, just just so that, you know, that I was really clear with them, and they still chose to make no comment and not to not engage at all. So, no.
Nothing. Okay.
No. It's very disappointing.
I guess just on that, I suppose, the sort of treating people differently or the indifference shown, because another thing that I questioned, and I mean, again, this was really early on reading the book, you know, why was, how could Cameron Slater be so hateful to another person? And that kind of, like, I mean, you've sort of spoken about how, you know, he was paid, so it's not it was his job really to do this, right? And it was actually, the hate was perhaps coming from somewhere else. But when you further on, you sort of talk about how, because you had access pretty much to everything that Cameron Slater had, right? And when you looked through it, the claims collapse like a house built on sand, you say. So so how is it that, I mean, you've said that Cameron would post things up, you know, a little bit edited, perhaps you could say, so that the full truth wasn't there, and then you could then insinuate, or it would be implied, that Matt exhibited this type of behaviour, for example. So in terms of, I guess, empathy, and again going back to the investigation process or the being critical about information, where are we at in the world if we're not being critical of information or not, you know? I mean, there are people in the book that you've talked to who dismissed this stuff, right? A lot of people dismissed the blogs. Some of those people were affected themselves, how do we fix this? How do we acknowledge that different people do look at things differently, but like you say, have different levels of empathy? What's the kind of?
Gosh, I wish I had a really clear answer to that. I mean, I think in my mind are coming all these other examples of where Slater did this. And I mean, the Matt case was a bit different from some of the other cases because it wasn't political. It must have been purely commercial. But I think what happened was that it became personal to him. So Slater was, you know, the monkey to the grinder, you know, the willing tool to this little group, this cohort of people that wanted to hurt Matt. And, you know, their motivation, the big, you know, who knows, you know, revenge, gleefulness, the experience of being part of, you know, of a gleeful group planning nasty stuff against someone. I think there's a bit of that. Slater, yeah, he was their tool, but it became his fight and he became the fall guy. And so it's easy to sometimes feel this kind of almost like a sympathy for Slater, and yet it's misplaced, because every time you start to feel like that, you come up against this example of incredible cruelty and disregard for the feelings of others. And, you know, he could have walked away from this fight at any time. He was the guy that Matt took the defamation action against, because he was so clearly the person who was making the platform available for all this stuff and publishing this stuff and claiming it.
As if
it was his own. But he was an easier target to take for defamation. And Matt, you know, very under-resourced, just had to make that decision. But, you know, really, Slater has taken one for the team. He's taken a big one for the team.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. Because one of my questions was in that whether there was any sort of resolution to the Matt Warren kind of dispute, or if Warren was ever held accountable for this.
No, he wasn't.
But then, because I mean, I think I read when Cameron Slater himself was denied name suppression, and he begged the judge to have his name suppressed, even after he had so many times, you know, actually written people's names who had name suppression, because he believed that people should know, and he made many arguments towards kind of getting rid of that legislation, right? And he actually, this was something that he actually advocated for, and then he begged for. I was just kind of like, well, that just shows, actually, I mean, hopefully maybe he would learn too at that point that what he did perhaps was wrong. Or I don't know. But
no, it's a weird, really weird thing. And it reminds me a little bit about the fake news thing in a way. Because fake news, so let's look at Trump. You know, we knew about fake news before Trump came along. But then Trump came along, you know, the archetype of fake news, and started to claim that he was the victim of fake news. It's this weird kind of cyclical thing where accusations turn in on themselves and you know, accusers become victim. I mean, it's all sort of weird. And Slater's a little bit like that too. Like he makes all these claims and assertions, like his right to ignore name suppression and then claim name suppression himself. And a lot of the things that he accuses other people of, you can see instances of in his own life. It's quite strange.
Or just a complete contradiction, which is a lot of what we deal with in that kind of fake news sphere.
Yes, it's confusing and it becomes too hard for people.
Just on your note of that picking the battle, right, between these two, because you talk about how Matt is probably, I mean, one of the few people that actually stood up to Slater, or at least continued to do so, didn't sort of walk away from this battle. And that, I mean, like you say, you know, Cameron Slater could have walked away at any point. I mean, Matt could have walked away at any point. What was it that kept him going?
I mean, I talk about it in the book a little bit, you know, trying to sort of understand the psychology of what it takes for a fight like that, because it's massive, you know, and what it takes from you emotionally and psychologically. Because every week someone's saying to him, what are you doing? You know, why are you bothering? And Matt would be like, well, I don't have a choice, because if I walk away, Slater can go back online and say anything he wants and there'll be nothing to stop him doing that. So that was a huge impetus. He actually kind of had to. He had to prove that what Cameron had written was a lie, or he would never escape from this thing, because there are consequences for Matt in every area of his life, like even trying to borrow money from the bank. Impossible. The bank manager looks him up on Google and goes, no, you don't Google well.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of stuff was happening all the time, all down through the years. So he kind of didn't really have a choice. He wasn't protected by any institution. And some of the other people that I talked to in the book who also were attacked nastily by Slater considered about whether should they take a defamation action. They were really disturbed and upset by the things that had been said, but in the end they were protected by, you know, by the context of their lives, by the fact that they were employed by, you know, the Herald, or they, you know, that they had some other greater context around them.
People
Matt had nothing like
them.
That
right
you know, he was just out there on his own, and there was nothing between him and what Slater was saying. So I think there was something about that. But you know, I actually, I'd really like to mention Scott Poynting, who
That was just incredible. Again, not really heard about that.
It was this awful, awful thing. Well, he was a professor of sociology here at this very university, and he was someone who had all his life, in his whole entire career, opposed hate crimes. He opposed anti-Semitism, and he opposed he opposed the actions of the Israeli state against the Palestinian people. So, you know, he was, and he opposed Islamophobia. And he took a stand against an instance where he stood up for the Palestinian rights in a letter to the editor. And as a result of that, found himself targeted heavily on whale oil, because Cameron's a huge supporter of the State of Israel. And this whole kind of global network of Zionist supporters jumped in. And before you know it, Scott Poynting was being hauled before a disciplinary committee, or they had to defend himself to the university. The Evening Post caught on to it and ran a big photo of Scott saying, hate crimes, professor. You know, it was just appalling. And as he said, you know, it got to the whole core of his identity, and it's still affecting him, you know, and it's, these
like
things are real.
That you acknowledge in the book that you were sorry to have brought up that pain for him again after he had sort of perhaps, you know, settled it to an extent,
yes,
having moved away. Yeah. But again, in that, so that whole process, right, the university did, you know, go through the disciplinary committee. They found that he was fine, but because his employment was coming up anyway, they announced that almost in a way that, the university, I would say, could have been probably a bit more even empathetic.
They could have been a bit more sensitive about the way
to the consequence of such a sort of basic statement, which it's an ambiguous statement, right?
It
doesn't actually explain anything. And so from that, Whale Oil can just infer or claim that
he
had everything to do with that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, I feel like the university probably was caught in a very difficult position and tried to play it both ways.
Or tried to just tidy it up, though, right? Yeah. And that's what Whale Oil doesn't like.
No.
He doesn't like to. He likes to keep opening things up.
Right. Yeah, really does. But, you know, talking about Scott, because it was very distressing for him, kind of, because retelling is often reliving, isn't it, in a way? And it was the same with, you know, the other victims that I talked to. You know, they would still be feeling this incredible anxiety, even years after it had happened. And so that was something else that was a big purpose for me with the book, was to just try and understand the actual effects on individuals. Mm. What's it like to be attacked in this way and feel helpless and traumatised? Mm. Yeah.
I just want to touch on what you were just saying there. You said, the Scott Poynting story, but because Cameron Slater is a supporter of the State of Israel, is he a supporter of the State of Israel, or is he very much involved in the pro-Israel lobby groups and therefore a supporter of the financial benefit he might gain from it?
I couldn't answer that.
Okay.
No, I don't know. I mean,
right, yeah. So his personal opinion is not actually clear, is that...
No, I suppose that's an open question. I mean, I actually had believed that he genuinely supported the Zionist state of Israel. That's something that he does hold dear. In the same way that he holds dear, you know, neoliberal or alt-right politics, that's something that I think he actually, you know, believes in his heart.
Right.
Whereas something like with Matt was a little bit different because it was, you know, I think he probably had to come to believe maybe some of the stuff he wrote about Matt.
Okay.
I don't know.
So that's where Matt is really because of distinction of politics and then Matt
and
being
then just simply the commercial spin of the dollar.
Right.
And Matt's not the only example of that, but
interesting. Because that, I mean, again, that's, I mean, he's putting such, personal information and opinion online for everybody to see, but there's also an element where it's not really clear who he is. I mean, it can be clear, obviously, and like you say, in things that he does write and he does hold dear in terms of what he chooses to talk about or not, I suppose you could infer, right, what he does believe. But, I mean,
but you're absolutely right.
He could
Once
be
you put
this
money in,
person who doesn't care about anything or everything.
I'll care about anything if you pay me enough.
I just also took a moment. I mean, I noted that it never would have happened without the internet and Google. Mm. And it kind of goes in many ways, that statement, because obviously Matt's life was affected because people could Google him and see these things. But also in terms of the internet and Google, I mean, the hacking and the information available and the hard drive and that sort of the kind of new data age, I suppose. Do you want to say anything on that?
I mean, it's true that this story wouldn't have happened, and it wouldn't have mattered if it wasn't for the internet and the spread of information so fast. And I've got a quote at the end from Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels, and it's falsehood flies and truth comes limping after, and he wrote that 300 years ago. So there's clearly nothing new in terms of human nature here, or our love of gossip. Mm. Or our love of kind of demonising people, you know, as we gossip, right. Believing the worst because it makes a good story. All those things are there, you know, in our DNA probably, you know. But it's hugely empowered now. And so I think it comes back to us as individuals with the kind of behaviour that we exhibit online. And it also comes to the structures around us that protect us and keep us safe. And I just think that's happened all so fast, you know, the incursion of the internet into all our lives. I mean, there's no separation between our daily life and the internet. They're not two separate things like it often appears. You know, when we're online, we're actually online pretty much all the time. You know, it's a revolution, isn't it? You know, I mean, it maybe... If you're your kind of age, like maybe, I don't know, 20s and under, it's been there all along. So, but for someone like oldies, it, you kind of have seen it happen and remember a time before, and now it's like this, and it's massive, but it takes a long time for laws and safety nets to catch up. And I think that's part of what we see here. It's like you fall between two things. You fall between old legislation and a new way of life. And so we really need to be thinking about that really fast and really, you know, really urgently. Stephen Price, who's an incredible lawyer, media lawyer, has written an appendix in the book about defamation. He says defamation law is broken, and it's really because of this. You know, it was written for the old world.
Right.
We need new measures, you know, so that things can be stopped quickly. It shouldn't take 7 years if your reputation has been completely screwed over.
Yeah,
something needs to be done right now. You know, there need to be quick measures and bodies and structures set up so that that can happen. Yeah.
So this conversation, I mean, it's almost happening. It's too late, right? Laws should have been changed. Not our conversation, not the book conversation, obviously. But actually, because he's saying in the appendix that we need fast ways of dealing with this. Mm. As soon as you kind of introduce this idea of quick measures, is there not a concern that you know, you just get something out of thin air and you don't know really what the consequences of that are, and then use that as a kind of band-aid?
Yeah, that could obviously, it's full of dangers. So I think when the Harmful Digital Communications Act was being planned, before it was brought into law, but when there was, you know, discussions and debates going on about it, there was a heavy, heavy case to be made for a slightly for different tiers within that. There was a tribunal was being mooted, so that the idea being you can make a complaint, there can be a quick decision, but then it's totally appealable, and the other more exhaustive structures come in after that.
Right.
But there's experts
minimizing
who can look
harm
at it straight away, make a decision, and then if you need to, you can take on more. It's really got a lot going for it, and that's pretty much what Stephen is suggesting here, and he's also suggesting almost like not separating defamation from other aspects of harmful digital communications,
right.
Maybe an entire kind of media tribunal of kind, you know,
wow.
Because it's a false separation, you know. Yeah.
I should probably wrap it up unless you have anything else you wanted to add, but I wanted just to touch on how you say, and I think somebody, I mean, this comes from somewhere else possibly, I think actually maybe Cameron said this in the book, if you're explaining, you're losing. Mm. And actually I read a book where that concept was used to describe the Brexit campaign, where, you know, the Remain camp was always responding to the Leave's statements or claims, and actually a lot of those claims were not necessarily true, or they'd be a sort of fraction of the truth and exaggerated. Mm. And so Remain was always saying, oh, but this is not true. I mean, the NHS, you know, doesn't get this money, or, you know, like, they're trying to explain it all the time, but actually the damage is done by the statement, even
that's
if
right.
it's not true. So I guess I'm going back to fake news again in this kind of era. And like you say, maybe that media tribunal is the solution. But for people also, what responsibility do people have?
I think huge responsibilities. Actually, just as I was finishing writing this book, the Christchurch massacre happened. And so I've included some stuff in that, because to me it just seemed really, really relevant to all the stuff that, you know, I'd already been writing about. And in fact, Cameron himself has said on a number of occasions, kill the Muslims before they kill us, those kinds of statements. He's completely, you know, involved with that kind of hate speech. And and so really, I think for a while there, he and all his kind of vitriol got control of the narrative. And I think that thinking people, you know, need to somehow take a bit more control of the narrative and not be back-footed all the time, you know, because I think we do tend to be very reactive, and perhaps we could just take a little bit more proactive. Yeah, it's a hard one, isn't it? Because I think it comes back to that tau iwi tautoko kind of way of approaching it, which is don't don't buy into the hate stuff. And what shocked me reading some of those comments on, you know, really racist comments, really, really kind of hate-filled comments, and they'd be replied to by people who are not anti-racists, but the anti-racists would sometimes be just as inflammatory and just as hard line. I mean, no one's ever going to change their mind if you're telling them they're a useless, you know, useless white supremacist. There's no room to move in there. I think it's really that I think we all need to look really closely at how we relate on the internet. I mean, that's not going to solve problems like what happened to Matt and to other people who are the victims of a campaign. But I think it could help quite a lot in terms of trying to build understanding and support for a less hateful way of communicating.
Not only on the internet, perhaps, but in real life as well.
In real life as well, totally, yeah.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. It's been very thought-provoking.
Thank you. It was such a delight to come in.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.